Erev Tov, everybody. דקה לפני שאני אתחיל את השיחת מדיטציה, אני מאוד רוצה לבקש מהדוברי עברית שאולי לכם איזשהו קושי בהבנה, אתם מוזמנים לשבת על ידני בפינה שם, שמוכן לתרגם ולעזור לכם, וגם אם אתם חושבים שלא יהיה לכם איזשהו בעיה, ובמשך השיחה יש לכם איזשהו קושי, אין בעיה לקום ולעבור לשבת הירדני, חבל אם לא תבינו מה שאני מדבר. So I want to talk a bit this evening about questioning. About asking questions and about the nature of our practice as a constant practice of asking questions, a constant practice of interrogation. There's a way in which I think, certainly in all culture, in Jewish culture, in Western culture, in our education, that we're all taught to ask questions, that we see the important and central place of questions. Richard Feynman, who's a famous Jewish physicist, said that his mother used to ask him when he got home from school, "Did you ask a good question today?" Right? So we know the centrality of questions, of the kushya in learning, in Talmudic learning. And we know how valuable they are because they stop us from taking things for granted, from taking things at face value. And yet the way we've learned to question is through analysis, dissection, interrogation, which are all valuable parts of human life and the use of our faculties. And yet, while that kind of questioning is extraordinarily valuable, it can also be harmful at times. Because we can get caught in cynicism, in skepticism, and defensiveness. We're taught and we're trained in questioning. And so often we end up questioning to show off our intellects, to undermine another, and to prop ourselves up to show how smart we are, rather than to genuinely discover the truth. At least that's my experience. Right, it may be yours. You may have found yourself in a similar situation. And then our questions become just another expression of aversion. Right? They become really just another way to complain and reject reality in some way. It's like the old joke, a waiter goes up to a group of Jewish mothers sitting together in a restaurant, says, "Ladies, is anything okay?" And so in many ways, at least in my experience, I can say in my own training in education, our questions actually stay at a kind of surface level. We don't question ourselves in a way which is genuine, which is threatening, and which is life-changing. So I want to talk tonight about another kind of questioning. A more basic questioning, a questioning, a curiosity, which is a means to discover the very nature of our experience. A questioning which is a refusal to fall into automatic patterns, and so a questioning which is a liberation, an action of freedom. It's interesting, we're in this time between Purim and Pesach, right? We're still in Adar, between joy and freedom, between the place of Ad lo yada, right? The place of the point of not knowing, a beginner's mind in a certain sense, and the constant questioning of Pesach. And there are probably two sets of the most famous questions in the Pesach Seder that we do. The one, of course, is the Manishtana, right? What's different this night from other nights? And the other are the questions of the four children, the Chacham, the Rasha, the Tam, and the she'eno yodei lishol, right? The wise one, the wicked one, the simple one, and the one who does not know how to ask a question. And generally in that sort of hierarchy, we think of the chacham as the good guy, the big shot, right? The rasha is the troublemaker, and the tam, the she'eno yodei lishol, they're the little kids, the simple people. We have to sort of reach out to them in some way. But I think it's the opposite. I think if we actually look at the questions, the tam and the she'eno yodei lishol are actually asking in the deepest way. In the deepest way. And probably the first hint for that, for those interested in the textual piece, is that this word tam, of course, which we think of as simple, is actually a term of great praise in Jewish spiritual literature. Right? So Yaakov is ish tam, yoshev ohalim. Right? That's a description of our ancestor Yaakov. He is an ish tam. It's a great praise. Tmimut. It's one of the central and most important qualities in Hasidic literature, in Kabbalistic literature, that we want to acquire. This quality of simplicity. So the Chacham Mahu Omer, right? That's how each one starts. It's Chacham Mahu Omer. And he says, Ma'i dut v'chukim v'chule. And he asks, what are the laws? What are the details? He wants to know the details. Rasha Mahu Omer, he asks, what's this service to you? Tam Mahu Omer, Mazot. Mazot. What is this? Just that, it's like, what is this? Right? What is this? The Chacham asks for information. For details. The Rasha in some way sets himself apart. And the Tam asks the most basic question. What is this? What's happening here? And it's interesting the answers they each receive. The Chacham gets an answer of all the details. The Rasha gets an answer which sets him apart. And the Tam and the She'eno Yodei Lishol get a story. They get the story of the Exodus, the story and experience of liberation. And I think it's interesting because we do this whole Seder, right? We read the Haggadah, we're told explicitly, in order that each one of us should experience ourselves as if we came out of Egypt. Right? We're told that explicitly in the Haggadah. And the Chacham actually just gets the details about the ritual, which is supposed to give us the experience of coming out of Egypt. But the Tam and the She'eno Yodei Lishol get it directly. They're given the experience. They're given the narrative. And that's really the kind of questioning I want to investigate tonight. That questioning which asks, Mazot, every experience, every moment, every sensation, every thought, every feeling, Mazot. What is this? In a direct, clear, precise way. We ask this question 1,000 times, 1,000,000 times, and we ask it each time afresh, looking to discover again in this moment the truth of our experience, the truth of this moment. And in that way, in order to genuinely ask Mazot, we can't think we know already, right? We have to ask from this place of really She'eno yodea, right? She'eno yodea lishol, the person who does not know. And if we're reading, of course, at this level of sod, this level of parshanut, we usually read it, v'she'eno yodea lishol, at patachlo. The one who doesn't know how to ask, you have to open to him. But we can read it, v'she'eno yodea lishol, right? The one who doesn't know, let him ask, at patachlo, right? When he asks, then you open to him. And indeed, this combination, which I think we all experience, of the genuine questioning and the openness which results, the genuine opening which results, is what we're invited to experience. It's interesting, I was just talking a few nights ago, I think on Shabbat, to a friend of mine who's a lawyer. And he said, you know, one thing you know as a lawyer is you never ask a question which you don't know the answer you're going to get to. Right? So you've got somebody on the stand. You only ask questions that you know the answer you're going to get, which is exactly the opposite of our practice, right? That's what we normally do, of course. That's what's called judgment, criticism, right? It's like we think we're questioning, we're investigating. We're not questioning and investigating. We already know what the answer is, right? We're just producing the question and producing the answer in our head. But the invitation is to come to that place of she'eni odeya, to really be in that place of not knowing, and so being able to ask mazot, what is this? What is my experience at this moment? And to do that, as I think perhaps is already clear, it has to be direct. It's not actually an intellectual question. It's a direct question to our experience of the moment. There's a wonderful story of the first Chabad Rebbe, Reb Shneur Zalman of the Adi, who was talking to his son, Reb Dovber, and he asked him, what are you praying with? What are your intentions at the moment? Reb Dovber described his various Kabbalistic intentions that he was praying with. And then he asked his father, what are you praying with? He said, with the floor and the bench. Right? It's like, oh, right. That's what we're doing here. We're praying with the floor and the bench. It's that simple. See the floor. It's blue right now. Right? Mazot. What's that experience? What's the detail there? What's the vitality there? What's the width and breadth of that experience? It's so easy for me to say, oh, floor, seen that before, done that before, know that, nothing to investigate there, nothing to discover. But if I can stop for a moment and notice that I don't know, then there's tremendous richness. There's this place to ask mazot. The Pizetzner Rebbe, the Eish Kodesh, says something similar. He says, if you're trying to understand generosity and you ask what it is intellectually, you can never grasp it. You can only grasp it by the direct experience of generosity itself, by giving, by receiving, by being involved in that act of generosity. And I think what he's pointing to, which Jeff has mentioned already, that there's a way in which when we ask in language, there's no way to respond in a certain way but in language. And we're actually looking for a different kind of question. These words, mazot, what is this, are gesturing us towards a direct encounter with our experience, which just has that texture of questioning. It's a texture of asking, what am I encountering right now? What is this before me? And when we do that, when we genuinely do that, we expose ourselves. And that's why really questioning is extremely vulnerable. It's extremely vulnerable. Because we don't know how it will upend our world. We don't know how it's going to turn us on our head. When we genuinely ask for that place of curiosity and non-preconceptions, we don't know what we're going to find. And so we use this technique, or I've at least been really working with this technique recently, because it's an extraordinary way to escape our patterns, our habitual modes of response to our experience. It's a way in which we can genuinely start to question that which we assume. And not just on a surface level. Again, I think we're all trained to question our assumptions in certain intellectual ways, or at least I was trained in that way, academically, in my studies. But how do we do it at our most automatic levels? How do we do it at the ways when we automatically respond emotionally to some situation in our life? And I think the key which this questioning gives us is a wisdom and a non-reactivity. Instead of, I think the contrast to that is what I would call a trauma state of mind. It's not that we've all experienced some terrible trauma necessarily, but many of us live in just small ways in a kind of trauma state of mind. And what that means is that we're hijacked by our history, by our past experience. Right? We've had some past experience as children, as adults, it doesn't matter what it is. that past experience has created some way of understanding the world for us. And all of a sudden, we just fall into those patterns. We're in that same situation again. Oh, same response is coming up. Whatever it is. We get angry, or we hide, we run away, we get jealous, we get sad, we get anxious, whatever it is. We encounter the situation, we automatically respond. We start to worry. But what if we could cut off that process at its roots by simply asking, Mazot, what is this? As soon as that process starts to get going, instead of being lost in it, we just ask, what is this? What's actually happening at this moment? We start to be curious and we start to investigate. And that's the power of the Tam, of the She'ena Yodea. And I think this is what we mean, at least in my experience, we talk sometimes about present moment experience, about being here now. Being here now is not about not thinking about the past or thinking about the future. Every human being does that. It's a very valuable, important thing to do, right? It's not about erasing memory or erasing planning. Being here now is being able to be with our present moment experience and not to be hijacked by thoughts about the past or thoughts about the future, right? Not to be the slaves of our thinking, but rather to have the choice of how I'm going to use this moment. It's like I received this series of jokes that turn around, sort of Jubu jokes. It said, wherever you go, there you are. Your luggage is another story. And actually, it's a tremendous opportunity, right? It's like wherever I go, there I am, but my luggage, my baggage, is another story. I don't actually have to take this, you know, whatever it is, 30-ton thing I've been carrying around on my back for 38 years with me. I don't have to. I can just set it down. And questioning is the way we cut those straps. We've got this huge load on our backs. We're carrying it around. We don't know how to get rid of it. And all of a sudden we say, wait a second, what is this? What's this weight? What's this weight I feel in my back? How come I feel so crushed? What is this? And all of a sudden I don't have to hold it anymore. I want to be quite particular about this. It's easy, I think, also in these kinds of talks, to say sort of theoretical. So let me give you a concrete example. My partner Debbie says something, and I get offended, right? She says something, whatever it is. Maybe it's a criticism, maybe it's a judgment, maybe it's not, right? But somehow I take it that way. I get offended. And so, of course, I can just drop into my automatic reaction. Why are you saying that to me? I can start to argue back. We can start to have a fight. I can shut down, right? Whatever, my two normal modes of response, which are really fight or flight, right? Either shut down and withdraw, or I get angry back and start to defend myself. It's like, you know, one of Newton's laws are, for every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. And many of us experience, for every action, there is an equal and opposite criticism, right? But I don't have to fall into that. I don't have to. I can actually have the intention I try to cultivate, especially when I'm not in those situations, to first ask Mazot. Oh, Debbie said something. I feel tension arising. What is this actually? What's happening at this moment? Oh, tightness in the chest, energy in the arms, right? That's actually what's happening at this moment. Then I can notice it. I can investigate. I can ask again, Mazot, what is this? Oh, fear. Fear. Feeling threatened. Feeling unloved. Feeling rejected in some way. Then I can choose. It doesn't have to be why are you saying that to me? It doesn't have to be, I'm growing away. It can be, ouch, that hurt, right? In just a genuine way. And then it's a completely different conversation. It's not the same place at all. There's a place of real communication which is possible in that moment when we're ready to question in that way. And so it's a great question to ask yourself right now. How are you triggered, right? We all have our different places, our different points which set us off. I don't know what it is for you, but where do you lose yourself? Where do you assume, for instance, that person was trying to hurt you or was being inconsiderate or didn't listen or didn't care? When do we assume we know something? And every time we assume, that's the place to ask, mazot, what is this? Is this true? Just a great question. It's a very simple question. It's just like, oh, is this true? Is that true? It's a particularly great question to ask about our thoughts. We create narratives all the time in our thoughts. We create stories, and it's a wonderful human ability, right? It's a great thing that we do, beautiful thing. But it also gets us into trouble, right? We have an experience, and all of a sudden, we have a whole story around that experience. And the story ends in, she hates me, he doesn't care, he's a bastard, right? She doesn't respect me, he's abandoned me, whatever it is, right? We have our stories in the end with some description of the event. And we have those stories. One interesting place to investigate is because they make us feel safe. We tell those stories, we feel threatened, and the story is a kind of security blanket. One of my teachers, Michelle McDonald, she said it's like sucking your thumb, right? It's like you say, it's like it makes you feel a little safe. It's okay, I've got the story, I understand what's happening, I know who to blame, right? Everything's in order. It's a little bit safer, it's a little bit more secure. But our goal is actually to leave things unordered for a moment, right? Stories give us some order. They give some understanding to our universe and experience. And so it's very challenging for us to not have that. But that's our practice. We stop for a moment and we say, oh, what is this? Without imposing a structure on it already, we stop with the courage, really, to be in that place of chaos, to be in the place of uncertainty, and to genuinely inquire, what is happening here? What is happening here? It's very hard to do it. It's very hard. And it's because it's so hard that we train in it concretely here, where things are a little simpler, a little more reduced, a little less pressure in our lives. We ask again and again, is this true? Is this true? Mazot, what is this? And it's very interesting, you know, we tend to believe our thoughts. It's one of our great mistakes, right? We have a thought, we tend to think, that's what I think. I must think that's true. But it's just a thought, right? You don't do that with everybody else's thoughts, right? The problem is we just end up identifying with our thoughts in a certain way. So we think, oh, thought. I thought that thought. That must be what I believe, right? But it's just a thought. It's just like a bunch of words that came up in your mind. It's actually no different inherently than a bunch of words that came up in somebody else's mind and you just heard. Right? It's really no different. You just heard those words in your mind. So we train to notice, oh, thought. Is that true? It's not a problem that the thought's there. The only problem is that we tend to just fall into them. It's like, I think this. I believe this. Do I? Who knows what I think, right? And as we practice, we start to experience that gap, right? That beautiful gap, which gives us a little bit of space to notice, oh, thought? Oh, no, that's not true. Okay, don't have to worry about it. Go back to the present moment, right? Thought? Oh, insightful. Want to incorporate that? Great. Now go back to the present moment, right? We don't have to be automatically tied and enslaved to this process that's happening in our mind. Not a problem with the process itself. The only problem is in our relationship to it. And so we train in that relationship, in just asking, Mazot, what is this? What's happening here? Do I have to believe this moment, this thought? Annie Dillard, who's just a gorgeous poet, in my opinion, writes in Pilgrim at Tinker Creek, "The gaps are the things. The gaps are spirit's one home. The altitudes and latitudes so dazzlingly spare and clean that the spirit can discover itself for the first time. They are fissures between mountains and cells the wind lances through, the icy narrowing fjords splitting the cliffs of mystery." So we just ask this question. We ask these questions so that we can have those gaps, which she describes, these fjords, which are splitting, how does she say it? Splitting the cliffs of mystery, right? Making that place of mystery, of sod, of investigation, of not knowing, emerge. Lately, I've been using this a lot in my relationship with trust and faith, with emunah. One thing I've learned about myself is that as a child and an adolescent, and then of course as an adult, I shut down in response to difficult emotions. That was the coping strategy I had learned. Something difficult and threatening happens, shut down, shut off, don't feel anything. And I had to do that as a child because that probably was a survival skill for me. I had to insulate myself from what was happening in my environment that felt too threatening for me. And that was all I could do as a child, right? Those were the tools that I had. And so my experience as a child in some ways, not in all ways, but in some ways was of not being held. I wasn't being held. And so I had to take responsibility for myself. And yet this childhood experience translated in my adult experience in an inability to trust and to have faith in a deep way. An inability to really rely on life, on the divine, and to acknowledge the ways that I was being supported by God and by the world. And I don't mean that, I want to be clear, in a kind of Pollyannish, everything's going to work out okay kind of way, right? Not everything necessarily works out okay. That's the nature of life. It's true there are a lot of obstacles. But it's also true we are being supported. It's just true, right? It's just true. People are bringing food to my table. Somebody put in this whole amazing water system, which makes water come out of my tap, right? That's just the most basic ways, right? I'm being supported by hundreds and thousands of people out there in all sorts of ways. Right here on this retreat, we're all sitting here supporting each other in this incredibly difficult and challenging practice. So it's not about, you know, just looking through rose-colored glasses, but it's just acknowledging in very concrete and really clear ways that we are all being supported tremendously all the time. And yet some part of me, you know, doesn't really want to admit that. It's like you want to say it intellectually, but doesn't really want to take in that fact that I am being deeply supported and hold that in my heart. And so as I kept on asking, you know, Mazot, what is this? What is this experience of resistance? I noticed that in some ways as a child, I turned away from believing that life was supporting me because I felt I had to support myself. I turned away, right? And my resistance to it is that some part of me still believes it isn't safe. It isn't safe to believe that I'm being supported. Right? It isn't safe. Some part of me is scared. And this is precisely where I can question. It's like, oh, right. You feel scared, don't you? Of course you do. It wasn't safe for you. Of course you do. Is it not safe for you now? It's a genuine question. Is it not safe for you now? It's like, oh. Well, no, right? I'm not a child anymore. I'm an adult. I have a whole host of skills, of ways to be with the world, of ways to be with my experience. It's like, oh, maybe it's okay now. Maybe it's okay to put that foot into the water and see what it feels like to trust, to have some faith. I don't know where that place is for you, right? That's my experience. For you, it's going to be somewhere in your own experience, in your own lives. But it's that place of that genuine question to just ask, what is this? What is happening? To touch that experience and then just ask, oh, is that true? In this very gentle, loving way, not, is that true? You shouldn't be feeling that way, right? Just like, is that true? Total understanding. Of course I understand why you feel that way. Of course you feel that way. It makes total sense you feel that way. Just talking to that kid inside. And then just asking, is that true? Do I need that now? Sometimes we can really see the talk or the images that are fueling this false view, whatever the false view is that we have. Sometimes not. But one of the gifts that we're given, one of the amazing things, is that we always know when to question. Whenever your heart starts closing, right? That's all you need to know. You don't need to know anything else. As soon as you feel closing start to happening, tension starts to arise, oh, that's question. As soon as you feel, oh, question, right? Oh, what's happening there right now? That's all you need to know. You feel that first movement of closing, of tightening in some way, that's already your signal. That's your bell of mindfulness to just say, oh, with compassion, with love, what's happening right now? What's happening right now? And so we ask of that tension, the confusion, the anger, the sadness. And we ask not to analyze it. We may have some insight from the asking, and that's wonderful. But we actually ask not to analyze it, but to experience it, to have a relationship with it. The questioning is a means of opening. It's like the poet Rilke said in his beautiful book, Letters to a Young Poet. Have patience with everything that remains unsolved in your heart. Try to love the questions in themselves, like locked rooms and like books written in a foreign language. Do not now look for the answers. They cannot now be given to you because you could not live them. It is a question of experiencing everything. At present, you need to live the question. Perhaps you will gradually, without even noticing it, find yourself experiencing the answer some distant day. It's really the key. The key is to live the question. We don't even need to worry about the answer. It's not about the answer, actually. It's about living the question. It's about a kind of disposition of inquiry towards the world and towards our experience. And that's the tam. Tam, mahu omel, mazot. It's just like, oh, mazot. Right? What is this? What is this? As always, there's much too much to say. So, I'll summarize it now just to be a little bit quicker, sort of the next part. There's a beautiful discussion in Reb Nachman of Bratslav. He says, Just read you the opening line so you get the idea. Ki machloket hu bichinat briyat ha'olam. Machloket, disagreement, is an aspect of the creation of the world. And why is that, he describes? He says, because what happens when genuine machloket happens, genuine questioning in kushiyot, in Luriyat Kabbalah, the world is brought into being first by the tzimtzum, the contraction of divine presence, so that an open space, a void, can be present into which creation can happen. And Reb Nachman says, this is what happens every time we genuinely question. We create this void, this space of openness, of genuine possibility, into which creativity and newness and transformation can now happen. But to do it, to really do it just like God, we have to lehitzamtzem, we have to contract ourselves, we have to make space within ourselves for it to happen. Not to make the other person make space, right? It's our normal strategy of machloket and disagreement. It's right, I'm going to raise difficulties so the other person makes space, right? So I feel they're wrong, right? No. It's about questioning so that we all of a sudden say, oh, I don't know. And the way we do it, again, it's like, really, that's the way we do it? Yes, the way we do it is that the key is, when do you feel threatened? That's the key. It's like you feel threatened, that's the place to ask, mazot, how do I create the space here? How do I create the space? Because when we feel threatened, we know we're not questioning, right? As soon as we feel threatened, we already have this automatic response of defending ourselves in some way. That's our automatic response. And so we train to reverse that automatic response. We train to, in fact, have the automatic response be feeling threatened, question, investigate. And of course, it's very hard. Because I'm asking you and I'm asking myself to work with precisely what is most difficult for us. Precisely what feels most challenging to us. But what's amazing is that when we do that, when we're willing for a moment to not jump into with that response of defensiveness, but to inquire, to question, then that moment can shock us awake. It can shock us awake. One of my Zen teachers was describing a moment his with a student. And he said, you know, the student was sitting there. I can't remember the whole scene. But basically, like, the student's getting really agitated. And the student's like, I'm angry at you. And the teacher's like, you've been doing a job and you have bad breath. And the student's like, yeah. And that was it, right? Awakening for that moment, right? Just like, what? Right? It's like so random and so just like trivial and like attacking and not nice. It was like, oh wait, what? That can't be what that means. What does that mean? What am I doing here? Why am I defending myself, right? It's like, oh, it just shocks us for a moment out of that moment and gives us that space to do something else. Francis Bacon, one of really the thinkers of modernity, said, a sudden, bold, and unexpected question doth many times surprise a man and lay him open. I think it's a great phrase. I love that phrase at the end. Lay him open. It's exactly what it does, just the right question sometimes. It's like, I remember once I was on retreat, fairly long retreat, like 3 weeks, and I was having a very hard time. Very hard time. I was really suffering. And I was like being overcome by anxiety. I was meeting with my teachers in this group. I described my experience. My teacher, when I teach Amita Schmidt, she said to me, what if you felt exactly like this for the rest of your life? Would it be okay? I was like, and I was like, oh, well, yeah, actually. actually it would be okay. Like, actually, when I'm shocked for a moment out of that experience of like, oh my God, so much anxiety, it's so overwhelming, I can see that, no, actually, this could happen, and I could be present with it, and it could be okay. I didn't have to be trapped in that moment. And it was totally shocking, right? My first reaction to that question was like, of course it's not okay, right? What are you talking about? But just that moment, shocked out, and all of a sudden, the space to see what's happening, the space to question. And that space, of course, can often be, you know, a sense of humor about ourselves. I heard this joke recently. Hope we can all laugh at the parts that respond to each one of us. A Brit, an Israeli, Chinese man, an American are sitting in a restaurant. A reporter comes by and says, excuse me, but can I get your opinion on the recent grain shortage in the third world? The Brit says, what's a shortage? The Chinese asks, what's an opinion? The American says, what's the third world? The Israeli asks, what's excuse me? So it's like, ah, right. Just laughing at ourselves for the moment. And then can we have and see those questions which open us up? It's interesting, it happened to me just earlier this week. I was listening to a talk, and it was talking about some research on happiness, on people who are, the guys went around and did research, it's quite intense research, on sort of people who were happy. They went to like towns, and they asked around, they said, who's the happiest person you know? Right? And they went and they found those people, like 150 people, and they checked it out also. They checked out other people to find out, like, were they really happy? Were they just happy on the surface, right? And then they did a whole series of interviews with them on, you know, what do you like? What are the things you do that make you happy, right? And so one of the things they found, unsurprisingly in a certain sense, was that they all had a genuine intention to be happy. They all genuinely wanted to be happy, right? And then they sort of asked, and so if you want to be happy, you need a genuine intention to be happy. And at first I was like, oh yeah, of course. And I was like, wait a second. Is that my genuine intention?